Welcome back to our online Sunday school class, and we are studying the topic of encounters with Jesus as they are related in the Gospel of Mark. Mark's Gospel is very much like a docudrama kind of style, where the episodes from Jesus' life are reported to us in this very fast and fluid, hard-hitting manner, and we simply learn so much about Jesus and his interaction with other people based on how Mark presents Jesus' life to us. And Jesus, in this particular section of the Gospel, is courting controversy as he's confronting the religious establishment. The Pharisees, the teachers of the law from Jerusalem, have come down to investigate his ministry. And at the beginning of Mark chapter 7, he confronts them regarding ritual purity, or they confront him, and there's a discussion there. They're very zealous to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, but in their zeal, they built these man-made fences, these traditions around God's law in order to protect it, and they've actually undermined obedience to God's law because their hearts are far from the Lord. They're hypocrites, they're legalists. And so Jesus now points them to the heart of the problem. And that's where we pick up. We're in Mark chapter 7, verses 14 through 23. And Jesus called the people to him again and said to them, "Hear me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him, but the things that come out of a person are what defile him. And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked him about the parable. He said to them, 'Then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart but his stomach and is expelled?' Thus he declared all foods clean. And he said, 'What comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person.'" Well, some years ago, there was a newspaper that reported the following story. A young woman sat alone in her hotel room. The day before, she had left her husband and her family, her two children, to go and live with another man. And that evening, her new partner had deserted her, and now everything was lost. Her husband, her children, and her new lover, and in utter despair, she took her own life. The police found a desperate note left on the nightstand. The note said, "Don't cry for me. I'm not even human anymore." Well, at that precise moment that this young woman was taking her life, another event was taking place in the same hotel, a few floors below, where advocates of the New Age movement had gathered in the convention center, and there were several rousing speakers, and a well-known celebrity led the crowd in this unison chant, "I am God, I am God, I am God." The title of this newspaper article was "The Irony of Being Human." So at the same place and the same time, you can have very opposite opinions of oneself. I am nothing. I am God. We might be tempted to think that that young woman was succumbing to the circumstantial pressures of life. She was a victim, caught in the web of a series of very foolish choices. What choice did she have at this point? She'd lost everything. The weight of despair was too much. This was her only way out. And on the other hand, you have this New Age crowd giving voice to this divine impulse within, this jubilant expression of their innate identity. This is who we are. We are gods. But both reactions, "I am nothing, I am God," those are broadcast from deep within the human heart. Neither party was forced to act the way they did. They were driven by heart-level impulses. The heart, we find in the Bible, is the center of who we are, the center of our being. The heart is the nuclear reactor core of our identity, driving our thoughts and emotions and decisions. Jesus identifies the inner life, the heart, as the source of humanity's fundamental problem. Jeremiah 17:9. "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it?" So Jesus has been interacting here with the religious leaders. They have shown themselves to have a superficial view of sin. They thought with the right laws, traditions, the right practices, we can legislate sin out of existence by just putting the right number of fences and traditions around God's law to prevent people from breaking his commandments. If we just put up enough guardrails, then people won't actually violate God's commandment. And they wound up giving their traditions precedence over God's law itself, but they had forgotten the human heart. That sin has a way of sneaking around human regulations. Man-made laws are inherently porous. Sin infiltrates deep into the human heart, and that's why Proverbs, the writer of Proverbs, says in Proverbs 4:23, keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flow the springs of life. The heart being the initiating moral center of the person. What one person called our motivational headquarters. I want to know why I do what I do. I go to the heart. The heart is very, again, it's very complicated. I'm making it sound simple, I think, but it's actually very complicated. I'm reminded of the filmmaker Woody Allen, who was trying desperately to justify an inappropriate relationship that he was having with a young girl. He said, the heart wants what it wants. There's no logic to these things. You meet someone, you fall in love, and that's that. But if I open up my heart, not just the physical muscle that's beating in my chest, but my spiritual heart, if I open that up, I'm going to find what rules and drives and controls me, including all of my beliefs, motives, desires, emotions, affections, my intentions, all of this in relationship to God. Now, according to Jesus, the heart is the source of all evil in our lives. So we're going to look at two things here, the heart of the matter and then the matter of the heart. What is at the core of what drives our actions and then the matter of the heart? So I guess we're saying a lot of the same things with these two points. They're overlapping, but how is Jesus here describing this to the Pharisees who are all caught up in these various boundaries they're drawing around God's law? We see this in the first part of Mark chapter 7. We started reading in verse 14. If we would have gone back and read the first 13 verses, we would see this interaction between Jesus and the Pharisees and the scribes, the teachers of the law. They have come from Jerusalem, probably 90 miles or so to where Jesus is. They're scrutinizing his ministry because he's attracted so much attention. His popularity is surging. They have come from central headquarters, these huffy, well-educated, theological hitmen, to put the squeeze on Jesus. You might say the feds have come from Washington to question him. Jesus is leading this movement that is perceived as a threat to the 300-year-old Pharisaic establishment in Jerusalem. So they're coming looking for problems. They're coming to scrutinize, and it's not long before they find an infraction. The disciples, we're told in the first few verses of Mark 7, have failed to wash before they eat. This is not a hygiene problem. This is a ritual purity problem. So by not washing, they were ritually unclean and defiled. And by pointing out the errors of Jesus' disciples, by implication, they are pointing out how Jesus is in error as their teacher, as their rabbi, as their leader, implicating his leadership as deficient because he's not taught his disciples well enough how to conduct themselves in a ritually pure manner. And now Jesus sets the record straight in verse 14. He says, he called the people to him again and said, hear me, and understand. If we go back to Mark 4, the parable of the sower, this is something Jesus said a lot. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. At least a half dozen references in that passage, Mark chapter 4, to listening, hearing, understanding. True disciples of Jesus hear, receive, accept, and obey his words. True disciples are heart-level hearers. On the heart level, they are responding to Jesus. They are listening to his words. They are obeying his words. It was the religious leaders who were hearing, but not understanding. But for those who have ears to hear, the seed of the word takes root in their hearts. They bear fruit. They're willing to hear the truth. They're motivated to obey. What's Jesus doing here? He is flexing his divine authority. By calling the crowds, by calling his disciples together and saying, here, listen to me. I'm going to give you a proper understanding of holiness, redefining for them what holiness really means. So words like revolutionary, radical, sweeping, that they've been used to describe what Jesus is doing here, how he's setting aside the pre-existing framework, all of these dietary laws, all of these regulations that were put up to identify ceremonial defilement. Jesus summons the crowds, and in contrast to the theological hitmen who've come from Jerusalem, He recasts, he redefines, he reinterprets for them what true holiness is. The people have been taught that contamination, uncleanness, they arise from eating these forbidden foods. They arise from outside of us. Jesus reverses everything. And this is what he says in verse 15. There is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him. But the things that come out of a person are what defile him. The things that come out of the heart, not what is pressing in from the outside. That's not what defiles us. It's the inner impurities that defile things outside. So I think of what happens in Savannah when we have to evacuate for a hurricane. The governor issues an edict, issues an order, and when the whole city has to evacuate, all of the traffic on Interstate 16 is reversed. All the lanes are open on both sides. They're all headed west. The traffic is flowing one way. And Jesus reverses the flow here of defilement, flowing from the inside out. It's not what's out here that can defile me by touching it and becoming ritually unclean. It is what emerges from within, from my heart. This is the source of all of my problems. So it has ramifications for how we think about sin and defilement. Sin is not the result of my environment. You know, the whole debate of nature versus nurture. It's not the result of my environment or my upbringing or my inherent weaknesses or disabilities, the things that have caused me to suffer in this life, or even the way that people have sinned against me. Now, certainly those things, like my environment, like my past, my sufferings, being sinned against, all of those things can create a context in which it is harder for me to obey God, in which it is easier for me to sin. But our environment, that which is outside of me, is never the root cause of my sin. Sometimes our bodies, there are somatic reasons for why we might have a particular propensity for certain sins. They can create a context in which it's harder or easier for us to obey. But the body itself is not the ultimate cause of my sin. It might be the agent or the mediator, the expressor of my heart's foolishness and rebellion. Romans 8:13 speaks of the deeds of the body. So the body itself is not wrong or impure or unclean. It is what's coming out of my heart. Sometimes our relationship, the interpersonal aspect with others, that can influence our choices, but they are not ultimately determinative. The ethos of our surrounding culture can also shape the choices that we make, but they are not ultimately determinative. They don't force me to sin. They don't compel me to sin. The core problem of my defilement is what resides in my heart. That's what Jesus says, things that come out of the person, not what's going in. So here the Pharisees were trying to insulate themselves from sin by erecting barriers around potential violations of God's law. But they forgot that no amount of external insulation would protect them from the power of sin that resided in their own hearts. I think of the eccentric early church father Jerome, translated the Bible into Latin. You've heard of the Vulgate. So Jerome was this eccentric, rather insensitive individual who struggled with sensual passions. And he thought that he could overcome these struggles by adopting a rigorous, monastic way of life. So he retreated from the city, punished his body, lived an austere life, only to discover that his dreams and memories were haunted by what he called the dance hall girls that he had seen in Rome. So even though he had distanced himself from the world, had cut himself off and put all kinds of barriers up around him to protect him, he still had to deal with the evil in his own heart. Now, it's not wrong, per se, to put all sorts of safeguards around you so that I won't fall into sin. That's not what I'm saying. But to put those things up and not recognize the inherent evil in my own heart, the defilement that comes out of a person, is naive. So J.C. Ryle, Bishop J.C. Ryle, says that every person carries within himself a fountain of wickedness. I don't even have to blame the world around me. It's all in here. Ryle says, we need no bad company to teach us, no devil to tempt us in order to run into sin. We have within us the beginning of every sin under heaven. In our children, the seeds of all mischief and wickedness are in their hearts. It's not enough to keep boys and girls at home and shut out every outward temptation. They carry within them a heart ready for sin. And until that heart is changed, they are not safe, whatever we do. So yes, we do things to protect our children, and we are wise to do that, but do we also not recognize that within them there is this fount, as J.C. Ross says, this fountain of wickedness. Within our hearts, there is this fountain of wickedness that from which all manner of evil flows. Now this puzzles the disciples, and they ask for an explanation. And Jesus asks them in verse 18, "Are you also without understanding?" This is a recurring theme in Mark's gospel. The disciples are slow to comprehend Jesus' teaching. In this regard, they had more in common with the Pharisees. But to their credit, they stick with Jesus. They follow Jesus. They continue listening to Jesus as slowly, gradually, and painfully their eyes are opened. And Jesus patiently repeats and reemphasizes the truth. Look again at verse 18. "Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart, but his stomach, and is expelled? And thus he declared all foods clean." Mark adding this parenthetical editorial statement, Jesus declaring all foods clean, meaning he's single-handedly sweeping away all of those dietary laws from the Old Testament, some which were there in the Old Testament, some which had been added to and embellished perhaps by the Pharisees in a legalistic manner. But Jesus showing that he himself is the ultimate fulfillment. He is the ultimate intent and purpose of those laws. And by doing that, saying you are now free to eat bacon and barbecue and shrimp and so forth. The laws were originally intended to help the Israelites understand God's holiness, to understand the consequences of sin, to understand the barriers that sin was to fellowship with God. But when Jesus dies on the cross, the barriers to fellowship with God are removed, and the ceremonial laws are no longer needed. And this is something that, you know, here the disciples are struggling with, and later on the disciples would still struggle with. These are very hard things to unlearn. So Peter, in Acts chapter 10, has this vision of the sheep descending from heaven with all manner of unclean animals, and he's instructed to kill and eat, and he refuses. And the voice from heaven says, "What God has made clean, do not call common." A precursor to the entrance of the Gentiles into the kingdom of God. And Peter was still having trouble understanding and coping with these dietary laws, even at that point. So Jesus gets to the heart of the matter by then giving more explanation about the matter of the heart. And he restates the principle again in verse 20. What comes out of a person is what defiles him. And then he gives this list. For within, out of the heart of man come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person. Now, Jesus is providing for us a taxonomy of sin. If you take evil thoughts as the umbrella category here, Jesus then lists 12 different terms, 6 terms in the plural, that indicate evil actions, like immorality, theft, murder, so forth, and then 6 terms in the singular that indicate evil attitudes or character traits, like deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. You come away from this verse and you say, this is a very ugly portrait of humanity, isn't it? It's not very flattering. The whole idea that humankind, that humanity is bent in the direction of goodness, is greatly mistaken. For the seeds of all of these sins lie dormant in every one of our hearts. As Ryle said, within my heart is a fountain of wickedness. With the proper provocation, it can flow forth. In every heart lies the seeds of every possible sin. And therefore we are encouraged as God's people to root out sin, to guard our hearts. Keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flow the issues of life. But apart from God's restraining and saving grace, those evil actions and attitudes will rise up and unleash their foul effects upon humanity. It was a few years ago that Hurricane Irma was threatening Savannah, and we were all having to evacuate. I was getting the house ready for evacuation, and I was moving some of our deck furniture into our garage storage area, and the deck umbrella had been closed for a good bit of the summer. And when I got it inside the garage, I remember opening it up, and I don't remember why I opened it up. Maybe I wanted to make sure it was all cleaned out. And as I opened it up, something plopped to the ground. And I looked, and it was a wasp nest full of wasps, and it had been tucked inside this closed umbrella. Well, as soon as I heard that, as soon as I saw that nest hit the ground, I bolted for the door as fast as I could. I mean, have you ever witnessed angry wasps rising up from their hiding place after being disturbed? They swarm, they attack. Now, we read these verses and they depict for us this ugly swarm of death and evil rising up from within the soul of man. The heart is the source of all evil and defilement. Jesus includes here sins of debasement, debauchery, sins of defiance and rebellion, sins of speech and slander. Now, you remember when you went to the doctor as a child, maybe even as an adult, the doctor does the same thing. Well, he would take the tongue depressor and he would examine the inside of your mouth. You say, ah, he opens your mouth, he looks inside. He can tell a lot about your overall physical health just by looking inside your mouth. And what comes out of our mouths is an accurate picture of our inner heart health. So Jesus says, for out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Well, what is required to deliver us from the inescapable influence of sin that resides in all of our hearts? Is it more education? Is it more culture, more social reform? As good as these things can be. Now, a radically depraved heart needs radical transformation. We all need the regenerating power of the Holy Spirit. There is no power in the world that can make a bad heart good. Only the gospel can affect that change. And Jesus said in John 3, verse 3, truly I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. We need new hearts. And the Lord promises in Ezekiel 36, 26, I will give you a new heart, and a new spirit I will put within you, and I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. That's the promise of the gospel, that Jesus will make all things new, that he redeems us with his precious blood, that he makes us new creations. He brings us out of death into life. We all need heart-level change so that we will have ears to hear and eyes to see and hearts that obey. Only Jesus can make that happen. And so I ask you today, will you ask Jesus to change your heart? Have you asked Jesus to change your heart? And if you are committed to Christ, will you recognize the need for that ongoing change? Even once we get a new heart and we are clean from the inside out, we still need ongoing cleansing. But remember that we need Christ. Only Jesus can make that happen. Will you ask him to change your heart?